Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, October 29th. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, Associate Editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
Senior Editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And Senior Writer Saurabh Amari. Hi, Saurabh.
Hi, John.
Obviously, a terrible day, terrible weekend, terrible week. We sit here in the aftermath of the massacre at the Tree of Life synagogue in Pittsburgh. 11 dead, 6 injured, 4 cops injured. Robert Bowers charged with 29 separate crimes. Apparently told the SWAT officer who arrested him that all the Jews needed to die. And I have many thoughts about this, but why don't you guys, Abe, you want to lay out your sense of things?
Well, as I was saying right before the mics went on, that when they released the names of the victims yesterday, I had sort of I was reading them through, and I started attempting to console myself with the idea that there were many of them that were significantly older than. I would have thought people in their 80s and well into their 90s, and then, but I immediately then found myself sort of saddened in another way, struck by thinking about a different kind of fragility in these victims and what they had lived through, only to die at that point in that most awful way.
I do remember telling my wife, because we had heard that this was a bris, that I didn't want to look up the list, because I had this horror. This was early in the hours where they had said 11 or 10 dead, but they hadn't released, they hadn't confirmed who they were. And I was horrified to think that, God forbid, something had happened to the baby. But thank God.
So we're obviously going to go into the broader societal implications here. That's sort of what we do. But I remember a bit of a confession. So I remember around late 2014, early 2015, having a conversation with my father about, you know, sort of the end of history. I had never experienced anti-Semitism. Really not the real thing. Just kind of like chiding, elbows in the ribs, kind of, you know, mock racial consciousness in high school. And that, you know, we really passed that. And he gave me a pretty stern lecture about you know, growing up with people with numbers on their arms, and how you know, this sort of thing never really goes away. And it wasn't months later until I started experiencing the real thing, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, and now seeing it manifest in synagogues. And my naivete was striking. Bit of a confession here. You can take that as, you know, as you want, whether you take me seriously on the subject or not. But it was the world I grew up in, which was felt like a much more safer place.
I received a letter this morning from a psychoanalyst now living in Israel named Miriam Wolf, in response to a blog post that I wrote called The Slaughter in Pittsburgh. I want to read this letter because it's striking in 10,000 different ways. Dear John Podhoretz, the massacre of Jews at the synagogue in Pittsburgh was indeed very disturbing to me and my family for a number of reasons. Not the least of which is that, A, we have a son who lives on Squirrel Hill. That's the neighborhood in Pittsburgh where the Tree of Life is located. B, we're Jews. C, and on Erev Shabbos, 2nd July 1999, a massacre of Jews was attempted in our Chicago neighborhood. That's West Rogers Park, where my brother-in-law lives, where most of the city's Orthodox Jews reside. Many Jews were shot at and the shooter missed, but several of our neighbors were shot and wounded just feet from our house. Our youngest son, Ephraim, who was 15 at the time, was walking to shul with a friend when he was shot by the hate-filled neo-Nazi who was hunting for Jews, blacks, and Asians, all of whom his crowd referred to as mud peoples. Many miracles happened for the Jewish community in that many injuries were inflicted, but no one was killed. However, in neighboring Evanston, Northwestern University basketball coach Ricky Birdsong was not so fortunate, as he strolled with his young children. The shooting spree continued over the weekend and through Illinois and into Indiana. The last victim was a Korean graduate student at the university at Bloomington. Wan Ju Yun was shot dead on the steps of his church following the Sunday service. It's now 19 years later, and there are still anti-Semites in America who are so driven by their irrational animus that they would murder and maim Jews at prayer. While these events grip us, it is because the size and scope of the event seizes the media's attention for a while. In the intervening years in America, numerous anti-Semitic attacks have occurred. Cemetery desecrations, bomb scares at JCCs and Jewish parochial schools, and arson attempts on shuls. And then there's Europe, where the attacks on Jews in France have driven the tremendous rise in French Aliyah to Israel. Unfortunately, the attacks are not limited to France. Notable attacks have occurred in Belgium and England as well. This cursory review of infamies is offered as a counterpoint to your conclusion that the heightened rhetoric on both sides creates an atmosphere where a spate of weird email bombs to politicians and a synagogue massacre are a predictable outcome. While I'm deeply saddened and disturbed by the political rhetoric, enough so that my husband and I made Aliyah a year ago, I don't think the facts about violence in America generally and about anti-Semitic attacks particularly share a correlation to the nasty political rhetoric so ubiquitous at present. Correlation is not causation. I empathize with the intense human need to find an explanation for the events that terrify and vex us, because an explanation offers us the delusional hope that we have more conscious control over our lives than we actually do. So I had completely forgotten this incident in West Rogers Park in 1999 in July. Miriam Wolf's son was shot. The Northwestern University basketball coach was killed, and a Korean kid was all by one shooter. Think about what this says. I mean, everybody says we're inured to school shootings and all this, but the truth is that anti-Semitic behavior, you know, there are enough anti-Semitic attacks in the United States happening in regular, you know, in regular intervals for one to become relatively inured to their existence. Thus, it was startling for people to discover this weekend when they looked that I'm not a great believer in the categorization of crimes and hate crimes and separating the two. But if you use this categorization, the overwhelming majority of hate crimes aimed at religious people or peoples for their religion is toward Jews and not Muslims by a factor of 10 over the last 20 years. So what does this tell us? Well, so we can start with talking a little bit about Trump and rhetoric and all of that. And Miriam Wolf has offered her extremely valuable and personal perspective here. It tells us that notwithstanding all of this, there is something qualitatively different about anti-Semitic attacks in the United States and anti-Semitic attacks in the world from time immemorial. The attacks here are committed by lone, evil people. Their buttons may be pushed by real-world realities like the caravan or statements by the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, as in the case of Robert Bowers, or by something else, or by 9/11, or by whatever. But they are not systematic. They are not group-designed. They are not an effort to advance a political agenda by a group with a political agenda. They are lone acts. Anti-Semitism, where it is dangerous and existentialist, life-threatening, and threatening to the history of future of the Jewish people, is always organized, often at the state level, though not exclusively, right? That's, England in the 12th century, the Crusaders, Spain and Portugal in the 15th century, Poland in the 17th century, Russia in the 19th century, Germany in the 20th century, the PLO, Al-Qaeda. These are not necessarily state actors, but they are organized semi-state players. Jews are threatened by organizations that can overpower them. In the United States remains, next to Israel, the greatest refuge the Jewish people have ever known. And I, today of all days, as I say today in the New York Post, it is a moment to remember that America has been a home to Jews so much of a home to Jews that Noah has the very experience that Noah described, which is this seems unearthly that somebody could commit a barbaric anti-Semitic act aiming his gun inside inside the sanctuary of a synagogue, because it doesn't happen. It happens, you know, casual acts of violence and hostility toward Jews in countries where Judaism is either, you know, suspect or considered second class, or, you know, that's just par for the course and everybody expects it.
I think, I mean, what's interesting is that, so anti-Semitism is I think different from all other prejudices in that it is not, it's a hatred of the people, but it's also a sort of a theory about how the world works. It's, you know, it's anti-Semites believe that Jews are controlling things in secret, in you know, huge extensive networks that are keeping them and everyone else out of power, and that are rendering non-Jews is sort of impotent. I think the danger now, with that in mind, it's not the tone or the heatedness of the rhetoric now. I think it's that you could sort of cite as a sort of correlating factor, but it's something about populism that shares this very idea, and that's the inherent danger in populism, because it's also a similar idea about how the world works and about why one is powerless.
Well, let me say at the outset here that I think the people who blame Donald Trump for everything that happens are deranged. But we all experienced the kind of rise of anti-Semitism, violent, vicious anti-Semitism that correlated directly with Donald Trump's campaign, and he didn't disavow it.
Well, we need to describe what we're talking about,
because
it was all through social media,
occasionally some emails from some really psychotic people. It started for me. It was
around July
and August of 2015.
Okay.
That's when I noticed it, but it's indelibly burned into the hippocampus here, because it was such a shock. It was nothing like I'd ever experienced before, and we've all heard about it now because it's been pretty well documented, but it was, you know, people sending caricatured versions of cartoonish Jews getting executed, shot in the back of the head, your face being photoshopped onto somebody in a gas chamber, you know, the sort of anti-Semitic right that had been in the shadows felt very comfortable coming out, and Donald Trump sort of forgot about it and kind of ignored it, and then he would send signals that seemed to ratify these sentiments, like when he addressed in December of 2015, when he addressed the Republican Jewish Conference, where he talked about how I'm a negotiator like you guys, and you're not going to support me because I don't want your money, and that sort of thing triggers something. It makes sense to people, and then when he would refuse to say, you know, disavow the KKK, for example, and say, I need to learn more about this group.
To be clear,
David Duke was asked explicitly
about the KKK by Jake Tapper and David Duke, both independently.
And by the way, when he did it, he did it in a very interesting way. He said, I disavow, okay? I disavow, I disavow. He did not say...
Eventually.
He did not say, I disavow David Duke. He did not say, I disavow the support of racists or the support of the Ku Klux Klan. He repeated the phrase, I disavow, so that he did not create a soundbite in which he said the name of the people that he was disavowing. Now, read that as you will. It was clearly conscious. It was a conscious choice because it sounded weird. It didn't flow correctly. And I think the idea in his head, if I were psychoanalyzing him, it's not psychoanalyzing, but like trying to speculate, was he wasn't turning down anybody. He wasn't really going to turn down anybody who was willing to go to the mattresses for him. I mean, he didn't like them, and they're disgusting, but, you know, he wasn't going to throw it in their face. And that was the way he was going to conduct himself.
You can draw a straight line between that and what happened in Charlottesville. He did.
He did, right. So the question then goes to what how do we deal with the fact that in the aftermath of every horrible mass crime in the United States, the instant approach of armchair liberals, in my view, although I suppose conservatives do it too, but less and less, is to remove agency from the person who did it as quickly as possible. And then to say that they were acting essentially as some kind of a programmed robot of a larger force that was directing their actions even though they didn't know it, right? So the first time we heard this in the most despicable way, I think, was when Jared Lochner shot Gabrielle Giffords and five other people in a parking lot in Arizona. And the instant blame was laid at the feet of Sarah Palin because she had published or tweeted or retweeted a map with targets on it, one of them being Gabrielle Giffords. It then turned out that Jared Lochner was a very, very disturbed, paranoid schizophrenic with completely unclear mental processes, and that his obsession was with the idea that grammar was doing something to destroy everybody's brain, and that he was not motivated by the Tea Party or Sarah Palin or anything like that. He was clearly, this was some weird set of horrible signals that had crossed his head. And we go down the list that, you know, it's not the fault of the shooter, it's the fault of the gun. It's not the fault of, it's the NRA's fault. If the NRA weren't trying to do whatever it is the NRA is trying to do, then no one would get guns and then no one would shoot anybody and there everything would be wonderful. That's in a country in which there are extant 400 million pieces of weaponry. Whatever the NRA says about sales from here on in, that weaponry exists. It's part of, it exists in the United States. It's not going somehow to be magically teleported,
right,
you know, by the push of a button to a spacecraft and floating in space. But in general, it's the wish to assign blame to the person you don't, the people, the forces, the people you don't like in the culture for events like this. And when you get to anti-Semitism, this is where it's very striking. So there is clearly a role being played, was played by the caravan story and the role of Hias that led to Robert Bowers leaving his home Saturday morning and shooting up the Tree of Life. But as Miriam Wolf's letter reminds us, no such thing drove the shooter in West Rogers Park in July of 1999, where fortunately no Jews were killed, but a great many might have been. Or at the shooting up of the JCC in San Francisco, or in Seattle, or, you know, various other places. Those were Islamist attacks, which were an effort to make sure that as many Jews as possible would die.
Kate Hopkins, who's a pretty much a racist in the UK, has a pretty big footprint in conservative media over there, said that you don't have to look any further than this particular synagogue's rabbi and his endorsement for open borders immigration policies. That's what animated the shooter. That's what animates anti-Semitism all over the world.
Amazingly,
sort of justified.
You also have on the other end of the political spectrum in the UK, Jenny Tung, who's this Lib Dem kook, basically, who represents more the far left, who said immediately on Facebook, this attack is terrible, but sometimes I wonder, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but really this was the sentiment that I wonder if Jews realize how much their support for Israeli policies against the Palestinians bring this on. So to answer your question, John, about why we, I mean, I think one answer might be that we don't have a good account of evil, and of the sheer existence of evil. You know, whether demonic forces, you know, or some account that explains why people do hateful things on its own terms rather than in terms of kind of broad sociological development. So we try to psychoanalyze too much, I think, sociologize too much, and politicize too much. In other words, the answer to everything is what happens at the level of political decision making. But to go back to a point you made, John, about the difference of the U.S. as this exceptional refuge for the Jewish people, I think one measure of that is the fact that when this sort of thing happens, set aside the craziness on Twitter, the reaction uniformly is a kind of absolute horror, absolute confrontation, or absolute resolve to confront it, and no sort of funny business about casting blames on victims, which is not the case, as I was saying in the pre-show, oftentimes in Europe, where a certain kind of high-handed anti-Semitism abets or excuses or justifies the low street-level thuggery-style anti-Semitism. So, for example, Mitterrand in the 80s, famously, when there had been a shooting at a restaurant, said, X many innocent.
It was an anti-Semitic attack.
Yeah. And he said, X many people died, innocent people died, plus some Jews. And I think that mentality, which we see in Jenny Tung and which see maybe in Katie Hopkins in her own way, is this idea that Jews, unlike other innocent civilians, are somehow combatants in some XYZ cultural war, whether that's a dispute with the Arabs or whether that's their role in politics that somehow makes them more likely to get victimized, and shouldn't they really explore why that is? And it sort of turns back to the victim. Largely, I would say that's absent in the U.S. political dynamic. We really, mainstream responsible
figures
don't do
that. And why would that be? This gets back to my point about the Jewish life in America, because Jews are others in almost every other country in the world, aside from Israel. Even in liberal democracies like France, like Britain, Jews feel themselves to be other, and at times of political strife or political confrontation or sort of a direct political aggression toward them on the part, say, of burgeoning Arab and Muslim populations, the impulse of a lot of people, not even an ideological impulse, but more a kind of political majoritarian impulse, is to say, well, look, if everyone's so mad at them, they probably have a case. If there are 10 times as many Muslims as Jews in my district, I should probably pay attention to what the Muslims are saying and try to, sort of like listen to that, because I'm a representative of a community, and they're greater in number. Jews have never numbered more than 4% of the population of the United States. We now number about 2% of the population of the United States. And obviously, life has not always been beautiful, and there were quotas in the Ivy Leagues, and, the law firms wouldn't hire Jews, all of that stuff. But taken as a whole in the course of human history, first of all, the last 50 years have been paradisical for Jews. But, even if you take the 150 years before that, there has never been a country, a regime, a political system that was as accepting, and I would even say as openly philo-Semitic as the United States. And so Jews feel themselves, have felt themselves to be others culturally in a giant, world of non-Jews, 4%, 2%, whatever. But politically, Jews have not felt themselves to be other. And that, and I quoted in my blog post the astounding letter written by George Washington to the congregants of the Touro Synagogue in August 1798. This is one of these things that if people, studied more, they would know something extraordinary about. I'm just looking it up as I'm talking to you because I'm having trouble typing on my iPhone, finding this letter. But so
I will add briefly while you do that. Been rather hard on Donald Trump, and I think he deserves it. But so too does the Obama administration, for in policy terms, but also in sort of a kind of rhetorical or paradigmatic approach to what you said was this European idea of Jews as combatants in a global war. I think that was evinced in his comments, the president's comments, last president, and to Vox's Matt Iglesias in 2015, in which he addressed the attack on Hyper Cashier, which is a Jewish deli in Paris. He said, quote, "It's entirely legitimate for the American people to be deeply concerned when you've got a bunch of violent, vicious zealots who beheaded people or who randomly shot a bunch of folks in a deli in Paris." Now, the charitable interpretation of those remarks was that he was just talking about terrorism broadly. A slightly less charitable but altogether necessary parsing of those remarks was to criticize them for calling this attack random. It was not random. And the sort of bizarre effort by the White House to sort of take those sentiments and run with them. The White House spokespeople who were quoted when asked for comment on that affirmed that this was a random terrorist attack, and then eventually had to walk it back and say, okay, yeah, well, an attack on a kosher store was obviously
You know what's so interesting about that is that it points out that there can be a problem at the opposite end of the rhetorical spectrum, which is sort of too little heat, That was so symptomatic of the Obama administration. Nothing is that people don't hate each other that much. There's not that much terrorism.
Or you don't want to inflame people the wrong way,
right,
and trigger anti-Muslim sentiment, right, which was constant, right? Which was the response to the Pulse discotheque shooting, where we were told for 2 weeks that the killer Omar Mateen
was a homophobe,
had been motivated by self-hating homophobia, right, when he had called up and said Allahu Akbar about 10 times to 911 as he was going through his massacre.
And that, like the Sarah Palin map, persists. I mean, it's very difficult for us to live in a bubble that secure that you can maintain these delusions for 7 or 10 years.
The important point here is that as Miriam Wolf said in her letter, larger forces are at work here than what happened yesterday and what bothers you in the current news cycle. And anti-Semitism of all forces is a larger force millennia old. In my piece, I reference my piece today, and Lou Weiss, who runs a carpet store in Pittsburgh, who has a wonderful piece in the Wall Street Journal today. We both reference Amalek. Amalek was the historical enemy of the Jews. The Amalekites were the Hebrews' historical enemies. And what did Amalek do? During the Exodus, in the story of Exodus, he went around in the back, orders of the Exodus, and there were 600,000 people, according to the story, on the Exodus, killing the old and the infirm because they were the easiest to pick off, right? Eerie parallel, right, to what happened with Rose Malinger, 97 years old, and the Rosenthal brothers, who were both developmentally disabled, 59 and 54 years old, picked off by... the notion of saying, well, this is about the NRA, or it's about Trump, or it's about something like that, when it is about the oldest hatred on earth, the oldest... continuing hatred on earth.
That's what it's been called. Yeah. And, John, just one more point, because I know you want to read that George Washington letter, but just to Noah's point, I just wanted one more example which ties in things that Noah and Abe have said of Obama administration poo-pooing anti-Semitism, which again, why I'm a little bit hesitant to credit or take too seriously this attempts to just blame singularly Trump, is his Obama's famous interview with Jeff Goldberg. I know I've referenced it in this podcast before, but it bears repeating that Obama told Jeff Goldberg in The Atlantic, in a long interview, that the Iranian regime says some hateful things about Jews, but it practices anti-Semitism at the margins, end quote. And that is a direct quote. And what he meant by at the margins is that, yes, they say these things, but their policy or their you know, the central thrust of the regime isn't about hating Jews. And it's such a
there is a small Jewish community in Iran that is probably the most photographed people in Iran ever. They are very prominently featured in international media.
If you believe, as the Iranian regime officially does, that the Holocaust was a hoax, or that you know, that the word Pepsi actually is a conspiratorial acronym that stands for Pay Each Penny Save Israel, which is things that have been broadcast on the on Iranian state TV, or that Mickey Mouse was a good-looking mouse or a positive-looking mouse, and he was depicted as a positive mouse in order to, by Jews in order to restore themselves from their former image as rats. Or if you believe that Jews are the sets of apes and pigs, that
by Walt Disney?
That can't, that, who was an anti-Semite, right, famously, but that can't be at the margins. Once you, as Abe said, anti-Semitism is not like other bigotries because it's a theory of the world. So if you believe that, it determines all sorts of other things. It determines your cultural policy, your foreign policy. The way you think is just conspiratorial and effed up. You know,
I mean, and the problem is, you know, you're going deep into text. Like, there's not even a reason to go into text about Iran. It's, you know, half or two thirds of its foreign policy are dedicated to the idea that that 8 million Jews living 1,000 miles away from
the
need to
problem.
Be white and need to be right. white, and it would be a blessing to the earth if they could develop the weaponry and safely deploy it in such a way that all those Jews were killed. That is the ideological conviction
that
of the regime.
That doesn't stay at the margins.
That's right. The I'm opposite sure of the it, margins. But. It's at the heart and core of the regime's, global philosophy. So I just wanted to read some parts of the – it's a short letter, but the parts of the Washington letter – because people are going to be saying it's no longer safe in America and America's never been blah, 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 and why it is that America has been what America has been to the Jews. This is written in 1790. Think about 1790, okay? Late end of the 18th century. Enlightened views of the Jewish people are not much of a feature of admittedly high civilization throughout Europe. Right? I mean, Jews are depicted in horrifying ways. Jews are still, you know, Jews are not allowed to have last names in much of Europe on the grounds that they need to be kept, you know, still Christians and Catholics believe that Jews need to live among Christians as a sort of brutalized people to remind everybody of what happens when you reject Christ's teachings. That was a very big thing then, okay? And there's George Washington and these guys over across the ocean who have been studying and learning Hebrew. Like, Jefferson and Adams were both conversant in Hebrew, reading Hebrew texts, believing that America might be a kind of vision of a new Zion, of the whole land to which unfreed people had made their exodus. So the dignitaries of the Truro Synagogue wrote George Washington a letter congratulating him on his election and hoping for, you know, great things for America. And here's what he wrote back in 1790. Gentlemen, while I received with much satisfaction your address replete with expressions of esteem, I rejoice in the opportunity of assuring you that I shall always retain grateful remembrance of the cordial welcome I received on my visit to Newport from all classes of citizens. The reflection on the days of difficulty and danger which are past, meaning the Revolutionary War, is rendered the more sweet from a consciousness that they are succeeded by days of uncommon prosperity and security. If we have wisdom to make the best use of the advantages with which we are now favored, we cannot fail, under the just administration of a good government, to become a great and happy people. The citizens of the United States of America have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more the toleration is spoken of as if it were the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving it on all occasions, their effectual support. May the children of the stock of Abraham who dwell in this land continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. May the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness upon our paths, and make us all in our several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way, everlastingly happy. G. Washington.
Privileged, rich, white male, whatever.
I mean, doesn't it make you sick? Doesn't it make you sick to read this letter? This man writes this letter, which is a statement of the beauty of common citizenship being extended to a people's who had received no common citizenship in the course of their entire history. 230 years ago now, right? It's a letter that could be written by, you know, couldn't be because no one was as literate as this. No one is as literate as this today, but, you know, by a mayor of, you know, Hartford in 1993, right? Not as literate because, of course, the sentence where he says, everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. That is a quotation from the prophet Micah, which, you know, I wonder, you know, has Donald Trump ever heard of the prophet Micah? I don't even know if Obama's ever heard of the prophet Micah, by the way. But, you know, so this kind of cultural literacy, shall we say, that he assumed that he, as a Christian, and that the Jews of Truro shared alike in understanding. And think of the concept also of the vine and fig tree. So the promise of the United States is that everyone, as the prophet Micah envisions in the restoration of the Jews to Zion, shall reside under their own vine and fig tree, meaning they will have sweetness from wine, they will have succor from figs, and it's their own, it's not somebody else's, and it's shelter, and it's separate. So Jews live in the United States as full citizens and can live under their own vine and fig tree, meaning it's not Sorab's Catholic vine and fig tree. It's not, you know, Sorab's prior Islamic vine and fig tree, you know, Farsi vine and fig tree, whatever you want to call it. It is the Jewish vine and fig tree, and it's fully planted in American soil, but it is also fully Jewish. That is what we need to remember when people are going to start trashing America in light of what just happened here. This is writ into the country's DNA. Now, can we, we should stop for a second and talk a little bit about, because I'm getting a little heated, so we might want to talk a little bit about calm. Do you have trouble sleeping? I did this weekend. Do you struggle putting your kids to bed each night? Yes. When you sleep poorly, how does this impact the rest of your day? It's not good, right? Okay, so that's why we at Commentary are excited to partner with Calm, the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation, named App of the Year last year by Apple. And if you head to calm.com/commentary, you'll get 25% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of premium programs, including sleep stories, bedtime tales for grown-ups designed to quiet your mind and relax your body, read by soothing narrators like Clark Peters from The Wire and Jerome Flynn from Game of Thrones, guided meditations on topics like anxiety, stress, and sleep, soothing music, and more. Abe, you've been experimenting with Calm.
I checked out one of the guided meditations, and it was great. I really enjoyed it. It was this very placid. There was a screen of a kind of like a sort of lake scene, I think, and then a woman's voice sort of walks you through the relaxing of your muscles, your facial muscles, and your breathing and so on. And it was great. I almost fell asleep while it was on.
Well, you were supposed to fall asleep while it was on.
I think they have different ones. This was just to
calm
right,
you.
Yes.
Okay. Well, for a limited time, the Commentary podcast listeners can get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/commentary. That's calm.com/commentary. It includes unlimited access to all of Calm's amazing content that will have you drifting off to dreamland in no time. Get started today at calm.com/commentary. Then get to sleep, and we thank Calm for sponsoring the Commentary podcast. Okay, so we keep saying people blaming Trump, people are blaming Trump, people are blaming Trump. So How are they blaming Trump?
All right. Let's do this. So there is a distinct, there's a difference between the violence in America that we've seen, really exacerbated and revived over the course of the last 2 years. There was violence in America before, as a political force. It's been kind of dormant for a generation, but in the last decade, I think we've seen it revivified. And there's definitely a difference between individuals who are motivated by ideology or racial tensions or what have you committing violence and people in a mob acting like a mob. There's something that happens to the human brain in a crowd. It becomes something more reptilian, and it behaves as Elias Canetti described crowds behaving. And there is a difference there, but I don't know if it is a distinction. And I will explain that by suggesting that populism, as we understand it, right and left, is tethered, I believe, in a way that is that's sort of inseparable from racial tension, from group dynamics and group hatred. The two are so concomitant that I think we can say they are related. And I'm not exactly sure if Donald Trump bears no responsibility for that. I think he bears quite a bit. And I think it's also on the left as well. And it predates Trump by quite a few years, but not a ton. I think he is a response to that sort of dynamic that has reemerged over the course of this last decade. But he's also responsible for advancing it and creating the tensions that we're at now. So while I don't believe that Donald Trump can be blamed for this attack and should not be, I also think that the kind of return of to street violence that we've seen over the course of the last decade is in part his fault, is in part the fault of political actors on the left, irresponsible actors on the left. And all of us are responsible for taking the temperature down. I do think that's completely reasonable.
You know, just to add to your point about it, preceding Trump, and it's just touching on something that I'm sure you're going to get into in a bit, the Occupy movement was what? It was a populist gathering of people coming together and screaming against the banks. It was about how, you know, this horrible system of the banks keeping the 99%,
and Democrats, yeah, to their disgrace, embraced it. As we discussed on the last podcast, embraced it. Said Nancy Pelosi said it was youthful and vibrant. It was going to be effective. Barack Obama at the christening of the MLK Jr. Memorial said that this movement had been vilified erroneously, just like Martin Luther King did, drawing an explicit link between this movement and Martin Luther King. And this was a violent movement.
It was wildly anti-Semitic, too. I mean, I wrote about it at the time. There were tons of anti-Semitic protesters out there with their placards, and there's conspiracy theories.
We published a long piece about this by Jonathan Neumann about the anti-Semitism walking by Wall Street. And at the time, and of course, the lying fake media, you know, the media that you're not allowed to attack because they're so wonderful and do nothing but promote truth and beauty. And Time magazine named Occupy Wall Street the man of the year in 2011.
Oh, right.
Man of the
That's
year. Right. So, and
Occupy Wall Street itself. Kirsten Gillibrand described Linda Sarsour as one of the new suffragists. They don't make distinctions when it
suffragists
comes to
for
liberal
for
causes.
This is why
Hillary Clinton embraced the anti-civility movement. Not
I mean,
because
we
she
should
agrees
talk street
with it,
violence,
but because it was some sort of demonstration of liberal enthusiasm in the streets.
But street violence always has its romantic defenders, right? So when the Los Angeles riots happened, you will recall when Reginald Denny, the guy in the truck, was pulled out of his truck after the Rodney King shooting and beaten nearly to death at the corner of Florence and Normandy in Los Angeles, the idea was that this was an uprising. This was an uprising, like in Les Miserables. This wasn't just sort of like a session of looting and crazed, you know, out of control violence, but an uprising. And similarly, you know, when the G20 meeting in
1999 WTO,
right? The WTO. Because there were follow-ons to it.
The Battle of Seattle,
where there were, I don't know, 5,000 arrests and hundreds of injuries.
$1 billion of damage
because this was the beginning of a sort of anti-globalization movement. You know about how you know Trump is so horrible because he uses the word globalist. The use turning the word globalist into a bad word started on the far left, not on the right.
In the 20s and 30s, it was already
right,
at
but it was re- right. No, but it was revivified.
But this is why those of us who are skeptical of Donald Trump from the beginning were skeptical of because he used that kind of liberal, democratic language.
That's right.
The worst of his speeches, sorry to harp on Trump, but because we had began to enumerate the worst of his flirtations. One was Miami. That speech in Miami, did we mention it?
I don't recall.
Or was it Miami or somewhere in Florida where Trump said Hillary with the international bankers and her friends and so forth. But I just thought, because we mentioned this before in the pre-show, that I thought he would govern as an anti-Semite at
that
point.
Right, okay. So the story is complicated. So we're just saying basically that the notion that people taking matters into their own hands because the law and civility and society won't handle it has no ideological, you know, everyone on every side of in the ideological debate has comrades who have flipped over into madness and psychopathy and murderousness and violence, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. That's all I'm going to say. So that's the reason that we go back. It's not to do whataboutism. It's to say this idea that is now being peddled that somehow, and believe me, it's peddled on Twitter every 5 minutes, that Democrats have no responsibility for anything that's going on, or liberals don't. Everything is conservatives. Everything. And they said in 2009, you know, the Obama Homeland Security said there was a threat from right-wing extremism, and the right, you know, screamed and yelled and carried on, and then they stopped saying it because they were worried about the right, and see, they were right all along, all of that stuff. So, you know, if you can source a certain type of hate to one side or the other, you know, good luck to you. That's just fantasy. That's just your own ideological bubble.
There are a lot of right-wingers who think that it's beyond the pale to criticize the president of the United States, point blank, period.
Right.
But also, in specifics, when he goes up on stage and says that congressman who body slammed a reporter,
right,
man, that was really cool, that is incitement.
Right.
Well, it can inspire people to violence.
Okay, so now, but
Donald Trump is very much a product of a pathology on the left, which blames right-wingers for every act of violence that occurred over the course of Barack Obama's first 4 years, when Barack Obama could describe Republicans as Hispanics' enemies and Joe Biden could say that they want to reinstitute black slavery and repeal the 13th Amendment and think there would be no reciprocal response to that among Republicans who are tired of being blamed for every pathological schizophrenic who shoots somebody. Then yes, they're going to ask somebody to stop disarming unilaterally and engage on the terms that are set by the enemy.
But let me clarify your point here, because I think what you're trying to say is that Donald Trump, the rise of Donald Trump is a reaction, or the popularity of Donald Trump in many quarters of the right, it was a reaction to libels committed against people on the right by liberals and Democrats and people in the media in the years prior, such that the idea that you were supposed to engage in niceties and be polite and a good boy like Marco Rubio, like a good solid boy, as opposed to being just like a slash and burn, screw you, screw all of you, you all suck, Barack Obama's a Muslim, the media, all, you know, you're the enemy of the people. And then this gets a willing ear because people sat there. Republicans assented to Mitt Romney becoming the nominee in 2012, even though they kind of thought he was a panty waist and like a guy who wouldn't fight very much. And then because he seemed nice and maybe people would like him. And then he's accused of giving people cancer, killing dogs, being horrible to kids when he was 15 years old. And Joe Biden, as you allude to, saying the Republicans are all going to put you back in chains. The vice president of the United States accused the other party of wanting to put black people back in chains. And that is acceptable rhetoric. So basically, I think what Noah's saying is a lot of Republicans said, the hell with this. This system is not right. You get to say anything. We say anything. You cut our heads off. We're not listening to you anymore. And what's more, we're going to embrace.
They're not listening to us anymore.
Yeah, we're going to embrace the id. we're going to embrace the id. You say we're villains, we're going to act like villains. You know? Fine. You know, we try to play honestly by your we're going to take all the pleasure that we can possibly take out of being your worst nightmare, right? That's hard. Now, we warned against this here in our magazine, Respectable Quarters on the Right, from the moment that Trump rose. We said this was dangerous. We said it was, you know, he was attacking John McCain. He, for having been captured, that he played footsie with the Klan. He did all this stuff. And that in the end, a lot of it was, and, you know, said that disgusting stuff about Megyn Kelly, you know, said disgusting, said Ben Carson was an ambulatory schizophrenic, said that Ted Cruz's father had killed Kennedy and his wife was ugly. Right, all of that. And we said, so what do we say? And what do we say about Trump at Charlottesville?
And more substantively said that we should track every Muslim in America and name them and number them and have a database in which we can make sure that
there are 10,000
American citizens
are
under our surveillance. So, yeah. And that absolutely resulted in reciprocal rise in tensions among the racists.
Right. So here's my problem. Like I said, you cannot blame Donald Trump for the fact that a man goes into a building and shoots 11 people. But people have said the mildest thing that you can say about Trump, if you're not a Trumpist, but you're not like, you know, our old friend Max Boot or something, you know, like where every word that comes out of Trump's mouth is an act of evil, is he's irresponsible, right? He's irresponsible. He should stop saying these things about Greg Gianforte, the guy who body slammed the Guardian's Ben Jacobs. Like, he should stop saying that the press is the enemy of the people. It's irresponsible. Well, let's parse the use of the word irresponsible, because it doesn't mean he should stop saying it because I don't like it and it's, you know, it's
icky,
right? It's irresponsible because it may have unintended consequences. Like, I'm sure Trump doesn't want anyone to go out and shoot journalists at his rallies. But is it unthinkable that some... I mean, I don't know what the security is like, so maybe it's impossible because no one could get in with a gun. Is it impossible, given him, as he said this morning, that the press is the enemy of the people, that somebody who supports him... What do you do with an enemy? You kill them. If this is a war, and remember, we're at war. Brad Parscale, the campaign manager of Trump 2020, said he is the leader of Trump's army. Trump has an army, according to the Trump campaign, and there are enemies out there in the stands reporting on that. Could someone shoot?
I can already hear Trump supporters listening to this and saying, "This is nonsense." You name the enemy, you attack the enemy. These are martial, references that have been used in politics from time immemorial. You're overblowing this. And what would you say to the other end of the spectrum, which is the quote-unquote resistance that pays nominal homage to an armed insurgency that has been warning that Donald Trump is a fascist organizing the takeover of America to some sort of a totalitarian system. And then about 6 months after this process, somebody got a gun and tried to kill as many Republicans as he possibly could. And you know that there's some sort of link there. You can't really put your finger on it, but you know there's one.
Right. And so what's the link in the Pittsburgh case? So the link in the Pittsburgh case is as follows. The caravan is coming up from South America, right? Central America, excuse me. The Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society is supporting efforts to help people in the caravan. And as a believer in, Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society is a resettlement, is an agency that has existed for 120 years, was there for the purpose of resettling, helping resettle Jews in the United States. Resettled Soviet Jews, resettled Holocaust survivors, settled. Okay. So Hayes supports the people in the caravan. Trump and the Republicans, everybody starts making like hay out of the caravan. And on Saturday morning, what did Bowers say? He said, "I can't stand by and watch these people destroy my country. Screw the optics. I'm going in," is what he said. So does the fact that the caravan story was publicized trigger him? Yeah. Who's responsible for that? Well, it's a complicated story, because the idea now is that it's Fox did it. Fox did it because they got hysterical about the caravan. It's so terrible, and it's Fox's fault. But the people who organized the caravan, people who organized the caravan and supported the caravan and were pumping the caravan to go north, also wanted attention on the caravan. That's the purpose of sending 7,000 people en masse toward the U.S. border. It's not as though they weren't themselves creating a giant news event.
And lots of mainstream organizations reported it. Sympathetically.
That is the Republicans' pounce phenomenon, which is the story is not the story. It's the people who notice the story are the story.
Well, but now to shift to the Republicans' pounce phenomenon, there's something to the Republicans' pounce phenomenon. I mean, we said when this started, remember, I think a couple of weeks ago, we were like, well, what is this? This is like Trump should be paying for the caravan. This is like such good material for him to get to rile up the base and get them to turn out to vote. Well, this is the problem with riling up the base. I'm sorry, but riling up the base, you rile people up, you turn up the temperature so that the water boils, and you put your hand over the lobster tank where the water is boiling, and maybe the lobster slices your finger off with its dying move with its pincer. I mean, you don't, these things, this is why you're not supposed
John
to, as
a lot of lobster.
It can't snip your finger off?
I don't think it can actually sever a digit.
Oh, really?
Digit. Yeah.
It's so gross. It's sort of blunt, how you eat it.
Very delicious.
It's disgusting. So good. Oh, my God. Anyway. Forget it. So forget the lobster. We'll move on to something. I'm just saying, so this is why presidents from time immemorial don't create political division, because you don't know where it's going to go. You don't know what you don't know where it's going to bite. You don't know what the unintended consequences are going to be of the polarization, right?
I mean, the administration could take a hard line on the migrants, though. I mean, the caravan.
Of course.
And they're about to, or apparently sending troops to the border.
No, but Trump last week complained that the bomber, the fake pipe bomber, whatever it was, took the media's attention off the caravan where he wanted it. He wants it on the caravan because that helps him. The bomber doesn't help him. So, the media focusing on the fact that 14 bombs that may or may not have been activatable, shouldn't have been as big a story because it didn't help him. Okay. My point here is that he is not responsible for the deaths or the injuries in Pittsburgh. He is not responsible for the evil that Robert Bowers did. Is he responsible for the degradation of, is he partially responsible for the degradation of our political life and the buttons that are being pushed all over the place that will have consequences because of their irresponsibility?
Nor is Fox News responsible for this, just as Rachel Maddow is not responsible for the assassination attempt in Alexandria, Virginia. Though that person was a fan of hers.
Right. Fox is not responsible. Rachel Maddow is not responsible. Twitter is not responsible. The world in which the world in which this crazed incivility is not only allowed to fester, but in which people are perversely rewarded for their service to the incivility. And this is one of the reasons that I got off Twitter, because I felt myself becoming a servant of a larger cause that I deeply don't believe in. And because I'm not sure, I was thinking, and I put this on Facebook over the weekend to see what people would say. Imagine 9/11 if there had been Twitter. How many people in the country would have believed 48 hours after 9/11 that it was a false flag, that Bush had done it, right? Because there was no such thing. This became a theme, right, in this disgusting subculture. The whole thing, was it this can't melt that, or steel can't melt glass, or glass can't melt steel.
Thermite,
I can't even remember
paint.
Right? All of that. but there was no way for it to sort of like ignite into a mass revolt against the reality of what happened. And I don't know what would have happened. I mean, it's just chilling to me to think of.
9/11 conspiracy theories were extremely popular. There were movies, television shows. Yeah,
but it took the
Jesse
tail,
Ventura, who was a governor of a state.
The tail was very long. I'm talking about at the moment of origin, when we had national unity on the horror of what had happened and the idea that the United States had been attacked and that the attack on one was an attack on all, that would have been... I remember when things started to turn. It was Susan Sontag writing in The New Yorker that we deserved it,
right,
and Michael Moore saying that if George Bush benefited from it, it had to be something that he did on purpose. And the world came down on them like a ton of bricks because the country was not – the country in its large majority was not ready to listen to such talk.
But by the way –
because we were in national grief.
But to the extent that that did find purchase, it was aided and abetted by the sort of precursors of social media, which is the internet and YouTube,
blogs,
and people emailing these amateur documentaries, right, about it. You know, so
but Twitter is saying. Twitter is was an advance on everything that came before it,
right,
and Facebook, obviously, but Twitter is a different kind of ecosystem because of the direct conversational involvement of people and people at all state and the kind of cultural flattening that leads, you know, famous people to interact with nobodies and stuff like that.
I mean,
that,
with the exception of this most recent atrocity, just about every event that results in some sort of terror or mass murder has been called a false flag by the people who think it's very inconvenient.
Right.
There's some sort of hidden motivation behind it. And there's something just human there that we have to make order.
Totally, because, right. But I mean, look, everybody had this thing when the bombs started turning up, which is, I mean, this is partially because we live in an age where we all beset by narratives and stories and movies, and like it would be like it could never be as uncomplicated as like an idiot in a Trump van sends fake bombs to 14 people that Trump doesn't like. Like, if this were a TV show, there would have to be a twist because it's too on the nose, right? Except too on the nose is Occam's razor. That's the real world is, if something looks like a duck, it's probably a duck, and it's not a horse that someone made up to look like a duck. That actually, and that theory, which is that it's a horse made up to look like a duck to get us back to our original, is the source of all conspiracy theory, right? Which is that which you see, that which is obvious, which is that the Jews are a tiny people, you know, just trying to get through history, are in fact the motive actors in history. And by the way, even if Jews themselves believe that we are the motive actors in history, that the God has assigned us this chosen role to fulfill mankind's destiny, just because we believe it doesn't mean you should believe it. Like, you know, I mean, go ahead and believe it. If you really believe it, you should probably convert in. But if you don't believe, like, you know, history tells the miracle of the Jewish people is that the Jewish people have survived. That is the only sign that we have some kind of supernatural or divine destiny, because every other tribe that was alive in the Middle East at the time is gone. And we survived. I mean, not every. I mean, there's the Zoroastrian religion, which is still going. But mostly everybody's dead. And have survived repeated efforts to extirpate us from the earth, right? So, and once again, I think I want to conclude, not to filibuster, but I want to conclude by saying that Jews are on this earth and will be on this earth for another 3,500 years, having been on this earth. The first Jew was Abraham. Abraham lived 3,500 years ago. The Torah portion that we read last week, Vayera, tells the story of the binding of Isaac. Torah portion this week, which is called Chayesarah, tells of the death of Abraham. So Abraham dies at the age of 175, according to the Bible, well contented with his life. Even though he'd lost his wife, his son Ishmael returns, and they have a reconciliation. Ishmael, of course, being the father of the Arabs, just as Isaac is the father of the Jews. And he is buried in the tomb that he bought from a Canaanite to put his wife Sarah in. That's the first Jew died, according to the, you know, as we read this week, 3,500 years ago. It's 3,500 years later. The Jews are still here. And if the Jews are still here 3,500 years from now, in large measure, it will have been because the United States existed and brought us in and kept us from extermination. One final word. final word. I swore I was going to say this. The Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, which was the motive cause of Bowers's massacre. So HIAS has existed for 120, 140 years, and about 4 years ago, it announced that its mission was largely done because there were no more Jews to resettle, particularly in the United States. No one, you know, the Jews of Russia had left. Most of the Jewish populations that needed resettling or wanted to come to America did not need help of the sort where they were penniless and needed apartments and, you know, social services and things like that. It was a noble and wonderful undertaking and helped hundreds of thousands of people, including Holocaust survivors. But it had basically run through its mandate. And so it was announcing that it was becoming becoming just sort of like a general refugee resettlement agency. And there are many of them. There's the IRC, the International Rescue Committee, and others. And I thought and said privately at the time that I thought this was a bad thing that HIAS was continuing. Not bad, but it was like, you know, one of the things about an organization whose mandate is fulfilled is it should say, we've done what we set out to do. We can now close up shop and leave and, you know, and celebrate the fact that we are no longer needed. We did what we were here to do. But it's a nonprofit organization. It has a staff. It has a belief system, whatever. So they kept on going. And as I say, I was like, ugh, this is just going to turn into another liberal organization that does liberal things and all of that. Well, because of what Robert Bowers did, I just sent $1,000 to the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, and I hope that it exists for another 3,500 years. Because it cannot be allowed not to flourish. If it is the cause of an anti-Semite's murderous spree, then, you know, it should be raised on the shoulders of every Jew in the world and paraded around until we can no longer carry it. So for Noah Rothman, Abe Greenwald, and Saurabh Amari, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.